'cause you're only a man, and a man's got to learn to take it. Try to believe, though the going gets rough.
Major World, oh my God, I love it.
History repeats itself, try and you succeed.
Thank you, Major World.
And you can have your dream.
You're the best. I'm so sorry, Tom. I'm so sorry. Forgive me. Forgive me. I hire people. They do a website. It costs me $3. All right. Hi, I'm Ryan DiPaolo. Welcome to the Cap Figure Podcast. With me, as always, is Tom McLaughlin. Right, Tom?
Hello.
Hi, Tom. So, this is episode number 46. We have a great show for you today. I'm going out on a limb and saying that. And I just wanted to know, Tom, since it's episode 46, I know we don't usually do this, but who are some players who wore number 46?
The one that is on everyone's mind is the one and only Andy Pettit.
Don't you tell me you think you could read my mind, bro?
I know. All right,
Andy Pettit.
Yep.
Most
famous player of today, Craig Kimbrell.
Wait, Andy Pettit, he was that guy who, I think he was a lefty, right? And he did steroids. He got caught for steroids?
Yeah, and then he became a righty.
Yo, he is the, in all seriousness, he is the prototype, and even at the time, for how PR firms, they should show video of how to get away with being caught on steroids, like PR-wise. It's like,
yeah.
One... be a fake Christian. He may be a legitimate Christian. Either way, you're calling God in for this one, right?
Yep.
So call on God. Two, admit it right away when you're questioned about it, right? And three, claim...
Or don't deny it, but then...
Right, if you're pressed, yeah. Right. Basically admit it. And then the most key thing, well, I don't know which is the most key. They're all key. Say you're doing it for the team. Right? It was not a selfish act. I wasn't taking money away from guys who don't take steroids. I was doing it to come back from an injury from my teammates. You know, my trainer tells me I could come back from an injury and be there for my team. I'm not going to miss a playoff run, right? And Roger said it helped him. And you know, what am I to do? You know, I'm a God-fearing man, and I just want to be there for my team.
You think I like needles? I don't.
You think I like a guy sticking a needle in my butt? So this is episode 46.
That's exactly how he talks.
Thanks, man. So you're saying that's a good impression?
Yeah, it is. It's like Madison Bumgarner.
Andy Pettit, I remember he did like the Brett Favre, but on a smaller scale. Remember every year it was for his last 5 years. It was like, is he going to come back? Is he not? Then he went to the Astros. And then, oh my goodness gracious, when Roger Clemens came back to the Yankees that time. That's what that was, that clip. It's like, of all the dramatic things I've ever seen, it's like, bitch, you watched like them win 5 World Series.
Yeah, and meanwhile, at the time, that the Yankees were dominant, and everybody knew he was coming back.
Yeah.
This wasn't like a grand surprise.
Yo, but right, Roger Clemens is in the box with George Steinbrenner. Oh my God. So, and speaking of steroids and Roger Clemens and Andy Pettit, Roger Clemens is the prototype of what not to do. Obviously, maybe he had more to lose, right, Roger Clemens, than Andy Pettit? But still, it was pretty much just PR, like, one admitting it and one not, and one, like, going all in on denying it, right?
Rafael Palmeiro, I put in that bucket, too.
What, of hurting himself by denying it?
Yeah, the whole, like, Senate hearing.
Yeah.
He, like, wags his finger.
I know. He's like, I'm not here. Oh, no, that was Mark McGwire. But
I did not do steroids.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Yeah, actually, you did.
I know. It's insane. It really is crazy to look at old clips. Like, I was watching a Yankees classic from... Oh, it was Pedro when he struck out 19 guys and had a one hitter. And the DH on the Yankees, I forget, the one hit was a home run. But all the Yankees looked giant. Like, everybody was clearly steroided up, even on the Red Sox, that it made Nomar Garciaparra, who, by the way, looks like a meth addict in the box. Do you remember that
he's
twitched?
Like all
jittery. Oh my god, dude, he's such a crackhead. Like, can I have a cigarette? Like, he like best tightens his gloves five times. He stomps each foot to
weird.
Tighten his shoes three times each before each pitch. So anyway,
he like cuts off the circulation to his hands every time.
You get a better buzz
like
that
they're
way.
On. Yeah. They're on.
That he said he started doing that because his cleats were too big when he was in Little League, so he had to kick his things in. But that's like crazy stuff, right? It's like, I was tormented from the memory of my giant cleats. All the kids were making fun of me on the team, and I never want to feel that pain again. All right.
Is that why Craig Kimbrell wears his little like necklace knot thing?
Dude, and as you and I have said behind the scenes, that Craig Kimbrell wears the prototype of a white trash, lower middle class, like suburban kid who thinks he's thug, who's not really thug, that like silver chain necklace that's
he's
like
seen
looped.
Some stuff though.
You don't know me, right, dog? You know? You don't know me. I've seen some things. I've been around some stuff, right?
This kid I know from the neighborhood over, he knows some people.
I made it out of that neighborhood, right? My parents moved when I was 12. I made it out. All right, so I know a kid who got shot, and I was happy when he got shot because I said to myself, I get that 1% more thug credit now.
Okay.
But I don't. All right, so anyway, today, this is a very long amount of time of banter. Sorry. So, Tom, what we're going to do is get in some of the most lopsided trades in baseball history, in recent history, or what is your criteria? Well, you'll give it in a moment. Sorry I asked and then interrupted you, right? And then I'm going to discuss rotisserie or head-to-head category fantasy strategy because Tom and I have been thinking as we sort of newly navigate fantasy baseball for both of us, both very high-thinking individuals, right? But we're new to fantasy baseballs, and we're struggling a little and figuring out, is it better to tank these categories and dominate these, or is it better to try to win them all? And so I crunched some numbers, and I'll give you those results later. But first, Tom, tell me your criteria, and let's get into these trades.
Yeah, so the little name I came up for this is Seven Sickening Swaps.
Woo!
There you go.
That's an alliteration.
So when I went into it, initially, I was thinking just the last 5 years, and all but one of these do fall into the last 5 years. So that's basically sort of the time frame I was looking at. So
you don't gotta sound so depressed about it, man.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to go chronologically, or just however I went through?
Well, what do you think? This is you just however they're written on the paper.
Yeah, so I'll just go that way. So December 2014, we have a three-team trade.
And the idea is that these are like what got us thinking about this was the Trey Turner deal, right, that I'm sure is on this list.
Yeah.
But we were just real, and then we started talking about Adam Jones and how, like, some move so far away impacts, so greatly shapes these teams, and you have no idea at the time, like Yoenis on the Mets and stuff like that. It's crazy, and then that's what got us thinking, and then you came up with this list. All right, sorry, go.
Exactly. So December 2014, we have a three-team trade. Two of these teams do very well. One does not. So
two of them do well. It's a three-team trade.
Two of them do very well. One does not. So we have the San Diego Padres.
Will Myers do?
Who net Will Myers.
Uh-huh.
We have the Washington Nationals, who net starting pitcher Joe Ross, Tyson Ross's younger brother, and Trey Turner.
Wow.
And then the Tampa Bay Devil Rays managed to take home Steven Souza, Rene Rivera, and Travis Ott.
Steven Souza Jr.,
Junior. So this kind of stuck out to me because, okay, the Rays gave up obviously the biggest piece in this transaction, which was Will Myers.
Yeah, he was
right?
The biggest name by far at the time in that deal.
Rookie of the year, had kind of a down year. So they gave up the biggest
Right, he was coming off his second year in baseball, right? And he had won Rookie of the Year a year prior.
Right, and so that's the biggest chess piece in this. And so they give up that piece, and it's interesting because they give up the biggest piece, but they end up with all of the worst parts of the trade.
Yeah.
So, like, the Nationals gave up Steven Souza, who was somewhat promising at the time. There wasn't an outfield spot for him with the Nationals. He had kind of flashed this power, arm strength. So he was, you know, the centerpiece the Rays thought they were getting. But then Rene Rivera's on the Mets. Travis Ott made it up for about two games.
The Nationals only gave up
Steven Souza.
That's it.
And I believe that they gave up a couple of other, like, minor league, career minor leaguers.
Okay.
But to net Joe Ross and Trey Turner, yeah, that's pretty big.
Who had Trey Turner?
Trey Turner was a Padre. He was a first-round pick from the Padres.
Okay, and so wait, now the Padres gave up everybody else. The Padres gave up Joe Ross,
Trey Turner, Rene Rivera.
Oh, wow. So, they moved equilaterally, right? I mean,
yeah,
they didn't lose. Obviously, clearly the Nationals won, I think. The Padres ended up better off. When you said two winners, obviously you meant them, right? That
yeah.
The Rays lost.
The Rays lost. The Padres, I would say, they didn't end up losing, but, I mean, it's not like they
right. The
completely
thing, the,
struck out.
The thing is that, like, they... Will Myers is awesome, right? And he's young, and he's great, and he has a track record. And Trey Turner honestly hasn't done anything besides half a season, and Joe Ross hasn't done anything besides half a season. But it's a shortstop and a starter. That's very exciting. And, you know, I don't know. They may rather have had those pieces now, like, instead of a great first baseman with a horrible rest of the team. But at the time, they thought that they were going to get good in one off season. Remember,
yeah.
That was when they were about to sign Justin Upton and Melvin and get Craig Kimbrel and stuff.
Yeah, and Trey Turner was drafted by the previous regime and was a first round pick, but speed was his biggest tool. And
you got to let your new wife know that you don't love her kids as much as you love your own kids with her.
Exactly.
Right.
So they kind of wanted to shuffle the deck. And
that's so sick that you just said exactly. That's not right. I was being sarcastic.
We're playing chess here.
That's
now,
messed
though.
Up. All right. So I guess we'll move on. But that is crazy. That's such a big impact on three franchises.
Yeah. I mean, the Rays. Imagine if they had Trey Turner and Joe Ross. I mean,
they might
lose only 80 games.
I know, they might only they might only be 4 games out of the wild card at the All-Star break instead of 7.
And they might get 4,000 people.
Right. They might have to only untarp like one section instead
to their bubble.
Yeah, yeah. All right, what's
their
next?
Convention center bubble. So this one obviously hits home with you. December 2012, fresh off a Canadian Cy Young season, the Blue Jays acquire R.A. Dickey from the Mets. The Mets, in return, get top catching prospect Travis d'Arnaud and Noah Syndergaard.
It's so crazy because I barely even heard about Noah Syndergaard when the deal happened. Everybody thought the Mets made a good deal. Some people thought it was a win-win, but I remember even at the time, people were like, good deal for the Mets. You sell high on a knuckleballer, especially when you're not ready to be good yet right away, you know?
And d'Arnaud was the centerpiece.
And d'Arnaud was the centerpiece, I know. He actually looks good now again, but still, he's not. He's been injury-prone, and he was the centerpiece. And Syndergaard is obviously the number one age-included pitcher in baseball, right? Like,
yeah,
if you did a fantasy
valuable
draft right now, he's the
yeah
most valuable pitcher. So obviously we murked it. R.A. Dickey gets lit up from mad home runs on the reggae. He gave the Mets a good season. That awesome. Sandy Alderson literally could get 2 years extended on his contract just off of that. He could suck. Like, he could start sucking and deserve to be fired now. And just he could be like, hey guys, remember this, and get an extra 2 years.
Yeah, it's
I'd give him it. I'd be
about,
like, you know what? Good point, Sandy. I'll give you a couple more million.
I think that goes back to the Mets scouting department for pitching is so strong. I mean, look at the guys that have come through that system. I mean, even you have Michael Fulmer is on Detroit. He came from the Mets system. And Syndergaard, even though I believe he was a first-round pick from the Blue Jays, he really, like, shot up the charts. I think his high school junior year, he wasn't even, like, projected in the draft pool. Like, he was looking at colleges, and then about 3 to 4 months before the draft. I think people started really noticing him. But so, you know, the Mets, I think he does deserve that credit. I mean, look at that pitching staff, and that trade is
awesome. That's amazing. That's the ultimate sell high, like the ultimate. It's like a knuckleballer who's never been good before. Like, he struggled his whole career, has two good years, one great one and one decent one, and then you get an amazing Cy Young potential every year pitcher. I don't know. You know what I'm... I don't need to elaborate.
Yeah,
go on. Who's
Dickey,
next?
Dickey, too. The other thing was that he got a contract extension with the Blue Jays right after the trade, so...
He wanted it. He was on board, too. He was happy to get paid because the Mets right weren't going to pay him.
So you factor that in, too. That's more value that the Blue Jays gave up in that trade.
The money, you mean?
Yeah, because, you know, you're not getting a pre-arbitration player.
Oh, right, 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 right.
So... This is the oldest trade on the list, but you really can't make one of these lists without this trade. December 2007, Dave Dombrowski gets hired by the Tigers that offseason to be the general manager. Previously was the GM with the Marlins, and the Marlins, knowing that they wouldn't be able to pay him the next upcoming offseason, send Miguel Cabrera and Dontrell Willis to the Tigers. And the Tigers get back two top prospects.
You mean
at
the Marlins get back?
Oh, the Marlins get back two top prospects at the time. Cameron Maybin, center fielder, who was a top center field prospect, and Andrew Miller, who was a top starting pitching.
Wow, that's crazy. That's I didn't realize those were the pieces for Miggy, because both of those players, obviously Andrew Miller is amazing. He's like the second best reliever in baseball, and Cameron Maybin is playing. I mean, he's not what he was supposed to be, but he gets at bats and contributes on the Angels. Obviously, Miguel Cabrera is the greatest first baseman of the 2000s. He's the greatest hitter, basically, of the early 2000s. I don't know. It's hard
Pujols
to say with
maybe.
Mike Trout. Yeah, Pujols, actually, you're right. Pujols is.
But he's been the most consistent over the past.
Not even. It's funny that I fall into the trap that I criticize people for. You're absolutely right. Pujols has won 20 more games over his career than Miggy. But, you know, for 3 years there, he was amazing. Either way, Miguel Cabrera is awesome. That sounds like a win-win for a franchise that knows it's going to be cheap. Right, in a franchise that knows it's willing to pay.
But here's the problem for the Marlins in this trade is
that they suck.
All of the value from both of those players was not realized with the Marlins. Like, Miller ended up having success after he kind of, like, flamed out as a starting pitcher.
Dude, the Marlins are retarded. They're such a joke. Like, I when I was living in Florida, half-ass, because I didn't like baseball yet, decided that I wanted to try to be a Marlins fan for a bit, and I started for about a week representing the Marlins, and I was like, yo, we've won two World Series, we got 97 and 03, right? I stole a Marlins shirt from TJ Maxx. I still have it in my room with the sleeves ripped off, and I started, you know, working out and becoming a douchebag. I really wanted to be a Marlins fan, but then I realized I'm a New Yorker and like the Mets, and I hate the Marlins, and their franchise is horrible. They ripped off everybody there for a stadium, and two times after they've won the World Series, they just dump their team. They're just like, you know, let's cash out. Let's get some fans in the seats and trick them.
Yeah, that's what I'm waiting for to happen.
It's amazing.
Cleveland.
It's the most, I know, yo, dude, you're not kidding. I mean, they say that this year is the test for Cleveland. Like, they've spent this money, and if they don't draw this year, that market is that market is not fertile, right? It's like they're just going to have to be scammed like the Florida market to get any money out of them.
This may, it would be a good problem to have if it ends up biting me down the road, but if I were to ever own a team in like a second tier market like that, I would 100% be trying my hardest to move it to a bigger market, because that's like the easiest way to make a ton of money.
All right, listen, reporter in 2042 who dug up this podcast tape as Tom's little Milwaukee Brewers are trying to move to be another team in L.A., He's just talking tongue-in-cheek. He's not going to move. Don't bail on the stadium funding plan. We need you guys to outbid L.A., right, and to drive the price up. So he doesn't mean it. He's not going to move.
the city of Milwaukee town we love council you. Versus.
We love you guys. So just so you know. Yeah, man. No, I know. It's poor Cleveland. All right. So, but whatever. I mean, we could get into a whole discussion about baseball capitalism, but it is what it is.
Yeah. So,
all right. What's next?
Here's another interesting one to me. So, January 2012, Theo Epstein is hired as the president of baseball operations of the Cubs. He hires Jed Hoyer as the GM, who was previously the GM of the Padres. Those two guys were together, obviously, in Boston before that.
They're a gay couple?
I mean, they work together.
Oh, they work together.
Together, yeah.
I thought they were together. Sorry,
together, but not that together.
All right.
So the Cubs end up trading for Anthony Rizzo, and the Padres, in return, get Andrew Cashner.
That is horrible. That sucks.
Yeah, and the reason I kind of found this interesting was because Hoyer drafted him with the Red Sox.
Right.
Then traded for him once he got to San Diego. And then immediately when he went to Chicago, they traded for him.
That's again. Really funny. That's just, I mean, in football, you see that a lot more with coaches, like able to bring over some special teams players, like Rex Ryan brings over Ehedbo or, you know, these like scrubs wherever he goes. And the last trade you mentioned, it's funny that the Marlins, you know,
yeah,
went for Miggy again. Yeah.
He had the inside information.
And then, I mean, I guess it's funny because on one hand you hear like people in front offices say they fall victim to the grass is greener on the other side a lot, and that teams tend to covet other free agents instead of re-signing their own, right? Yeah. Like instead of the Dodgers this offseason where they had a big free agent offseason, but it was just their own players they re-signed,
yep.
Versus something like the Indians or I don't know, you know, that can – easily I could see myself and other people falling victim into coveting other stuff. But if
that
you really,
sense, yeah.
If you believe in your, if you're really believe in your pick, I absolutely would want to see it through, right? Like I would, if I were a GM and like my job changes, but I made these picks, it's like, I want to reap the rewards of my correct identification. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
It's almost like, when you draft a player a year early in fantasy, it's like, even if you have to pick them higher the next year, I still feel like I want that player because I feel like I want to be right or something. I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But that's really interesting, you know.
And that trade, you know, from everything you hear, Rizzo's really the leader of the Cubs.
He fought cancer.
So, I mean, that's a cornerstone move that set the Cubs in the right direction.
Dude, he's awesome. He's Italian. He's good-looking. He's hung. He's got all the tools you could need. He takes walks. He takes hit by pitch. It's amazing. He's a cow.
He gets hit by pitch a lot. Crowd the plate.
He dump in the ball and let the ball hit. Take one for team.
Just hit me.
All right, what's next?
Okay, so the next offseason, we have another example of Epstein and Hoyer absolutely robbing somebody else. So the Cubs are able to acquire Jake Arrieta and Pedro Strop, both, you know, excellent pieces of that team last year that won the World Series, and they give up Scott Feldman and Steve Clevenger.
Jesus Christ. I mean, I know Arrieta began to juice 2 years ago, right, with the Cubs. He wasn't good before that. I'm sort of being facetious, but remember there were those rumors?
That's Joey's theory. I don't know if there's rumors.
Joey? No, there were people okay. Asked him about it. Like, he actually got asked about it by reporters, Arrieta, the juice rumors, that he got irritated that it got to that point. But anyway, he was a struggling pitcher,
yes.
Right? And I don't know about Pedro Strop, but either way, who's Clevenger? Who is these scrubs?
I mean, they both played. Feldman ended up going to the Astros. He
the
kind
other,
of fizzled out.
The other takeaway I have from this is there are a lot of Jewish names in this one. Epstein, I've never to this day thought about Theo Epstein. He's Jewish.
Well, his...
Jesus.
His great uncles were, I think, some form of Hispanic because were the directors of that movie Casanova.
What was that?
It was like a huge Hollywood hit in like the 40s or 50s. is like one of the biggest movies of all
time.
Damn
it. I thought you could become a GM at 28 without having like been born at third base. No. Damn it. All right. So I got to get rich so my kid can be
Ivy
a GM.
Ivy League degree doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, I know. And being very smart. I spoke to him on the phone. It was no type of interaction. But when I interned at ESPN Radio, he just calls like, hi, 1050. This is Ryan. He's like, yeah, it's Theo Epstein. Like, he was just like, I don't even know what, why. I don't even know why a GM would do radio in another market. It was weird.
I mean, maybe he was trying to manipulate the media for some sort of trade or...
You think could be worth it? Like, you think that the media can influence a market, like, that it can actually influence a team's thinking?
I do. I think the best example is, like, the NFL draft, where, you know, you'll hear certain players keep coming up, and then they're linked to a team, and I think it can impact how another team decides to navigate the draft.
That's a good point.
So if they keep hearing a player is, like... You know, the Giants are going to draft this tight end, and you're picking after the Giants. Well, maybe it's true, maybe it's not.
Yeah, that's
but
a good
you're
point.
More inclined to want to trade ahead of them.
That's a really good point. And so Theo could be talking about trade pieces that nobody's really talking to him about to drive the price up, things like that. That's absolutely a good point. Because other teams don't know the difference. Maybe the actual one team you're dealing with might not – they're not going to be convinced the guy hit more home runs than he did because of the media.
Right.
But they will be maybe convinced that, oh, there's these reports that they're talking to them and they're fake. All right, so what's next?
Okay, so November 2014, there's more.
Wait, let's paint the picture. 2014, everyone's terrified. It's raining, right? Everyone's depressed.
Everywhere or just?
No, oh, everywhere. Yeah, everywhere. Everybody's depressed. You know, Obama just got in office, but the economy is still
in office.
Yeah, he won in 08, right?
Yeah.
Whatever. All right. Forget my scenario. Julia, 9/11 just happened.
Yeah.
Everyone's
global
on edge. Global warming.
Really There's, kicking in.
Everyone has their own color TV now. Radio is out. Video, VHS is huge. All right, go on.
And the robots are coming. Okay, so there's more to this trade when you kind of learn the backstory. But so the Blue Jays are
Well, that's
able,
what you're here for, Dingy. Teach me the backstory.
Blue Jays are able to net Josh Donaldson, who's been a perennial MVP candidate since he went to Toronto. The Athletics are able to acquire Brett Laurie and Kendall Graveman.
Yeah, I remember when this trade happened, everybody being like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And then as soon as the season started and Josh Donaldson was killing it on his MVP year, right? It's like, wait, double what the hell?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is the backstory? Like, why does it make sense? Because even at the time, again, people were like, what the F?
Well, Billy Beane and Josh Donaldson didn't really have a great relationship.
Oh, I forgot.
Especially the last year, because there were a couple of things. So... the Athletics hitting department, coach, whatever you want to call it, they were adamant that Josh Donaldson not use a leg kick. Right?
Oh.
And so he had the leg kick throughout his entire life, had success. Then they were like, you need to stop doing this. So he stopped doing it and he started sucking. And so, he comes in one day and he was really struggling and the hitting coach is like, so what are we going to work on next? And Josh Donaldson goes, I'm not working on anything with you anymore.
Ha!
And he's just going to do what he wanted to do.
Oh, my God, I never heard that.
He knew he was going to be sent back down if he kept, hitting the way he was.
Yeah.
So he's like, if I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out my way. And so he did that. Then it sort of flared up. Donaldson wanted to take a day off. Like, this was before kind of the ridiculous rest routines like that we see in the past couple of years, but wanted a day off in a day game after a night game, and they were facing like a left-handed pitcher, and Billy Beane like freaked out at Donaldson and was like, I tell you when you get a day off, like, you don't get to pick.
Right.
And so it kind of just like flared up, and they sent him packing after the year.
Well, so I had heard the story of him asking for a day off, and that is bull. That is wacky. It's bull. Ask your manager first, right? Like, I don't know the details, but how can you go over your manager's head and go just talk to the GM and say, I need a day off? Maybe the manager was riding him and he was like, look, I can't play every day. What the hell? That is so interesting because it's like, yeah, on one hand, I don't think about that with coaching because on one hand, it's your career. You're the one going to be in the minors, right? You're the one screwed. And on the other hand, you have aligning incentives. That's what it's called, right? You and the coaching staff are on the same page. You both want you to succeed. So it's not like they have an ulterior motive. It's just a different theory on how to get there.
Yep.
And it's so got to be so hard in baseball because it takes so long for sample sizes to get big enough to figure out what works or not.
Correct.
I forget what it's called, for it to normalize the average.
Yeah, that, return to mean.
Yeah, yeah. The regression to the mean. So it's so hard to figure out if these adjustments are working or not or if it's bad luck. That's got to drive you nuts as a baseball player. And I can't imagine. Josh Donaldson seems like a guy who gets bottle service at clubs, like with Eric Hosmer.
I think he does.
I don't think I like him as a person, but I like him as a hitter. But anyway.
Phenomenal hitter, yeah.
He's hurt now. But that's crazy. So what's next? We're running on time.
Last one. This is a pretty infamous trade. November 2013.
And let's paint the picture. 2013. Now, Obama just was in office.
Now it was really raining.
Now really everyone, the country has no idea that they're about to be struck with devastation, right? Like they have no clue. Everything is – there's the riots in San Diego, right? The great 2013, the 2013 riots. And people are on edge. The race relations with Asians are at an all-time low. Just let's keep this in mind. So go ahead.
So anyway, yeah. The Texas Rangers acquire Prince Fielder from the Detroit Tigers. The Tigers pick up second baseman Ian Kinsler. And the Tigers agree to pick up $30 million of Fielder's contract. And so for a while, it was, you know, it was actually kind of looking like Texas won this trade.
$30 million just over the whole remainder of it? Yeah. That's nothing. I thought they picked up more.
No.
Yeah, and at first, Prince Fielder continued to kill it. So this was 2 years. Prince Fielder had played 2 years with Texas after leaving the Brewers.
With Detroit.
Right, he had 2 years with Detroit on his first free agent contract, which was $216 million, I believe. He signed a giant contract with them. And only 2 years in to trade him and eat some of his contract is really pretty surprising.
Well, Miguel Cabrera just couldn't cut it as a third baseman anymore, so you had to find a spot for him. But yeah, it was a ballsy move.
Is that what went into it? I didn't realize that he was failing defensively. Like,
I think fat. That was what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the reason why he's there now.
And you don't want to pay a DH $216 million.
Yeah, and I think that the contract was the bigger factor because if you think
they could just see it was going to be a bad contract, probably.
Yeah, and they had they had paid Miggy as well. They paid Verlander, so they had this enormous payroll.
And three guys, they had all their money,
which is why they had no bullpen for all of those years. So that trade.
That's great. Yeah, you're right, though. I remember being like, wow, Texas. But it absolutely is rape for the Tigers now because even without him getting hurt, Prince Fielder a year ago in 2015 had a rebound year, quote unquote, after struggling in 2014 and 13. And he only hit for average. His power was gone. Like he hit 300, but he wasn't hitting 50 home runs like he used to. He was never the same. So he was an out of shape first baseman who's not that good defensively.
But he didn't end up even playing first base, remember, because Mitch Moreland was a better
defender. Yeah, yeah, right. And I remember him getting credit for that he was like, look, I know I'm not a good fielder, I'll DH.
Yeah,
like, wow, that's so noble of him.
Oh, okay, great.
It's like, great of Prince to admit that. It's like, how about get better?
Yeah.
But anyway, and Ian Kinsler is continually overrated. I mean, underrated, underrated. I don't know why, I guess because he's not that exciting of a player or something. I don't know. I don't think of him as very exciting. Like, maybe he's just consistent and doesn't have, like, streaky, crazy Dozier weeks or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's a really good fielder. Every year he's rated at 85 or up in the show. He's good.
Yeah, definitely.
So
perennial all-star. He does it all. And he plays in a hitter's park, so his numbers could be even better if he were still in, say, Texas.
All right, so that's it. We got about, whatever, 15 minutes left. All right, so thank you, Tom. That was great. The next thing, here's the other thing we're getting into today, is Tom and I are in head-to-head categories leagues where every week you play another team, you can set your lineups daily, and you get one win for each category won and one loss for each category lost. And the categories are regular ones in fantasy, like runs, home run saves, you know, net saves, net steals, blah, blah, blah. But there are categories like saves and steals where you can potentially win that category every week with one player. You can get good in that one category very quickly.
So the most obvious example is, let's say you have Billy Hamilton, you're going to win steals.
Right, he's a one-category player, but that's a guaranteed win, right?
Correct.
But on the other flip side, and Tom and I were talking last night, it's like you draft all these other overall good offensive guys because they contribute in all the other offensive stats that you have, which in our league is OPS, total bases, home runs, runs, and RBIs, right?
Correct.
Strikeouts also, if you want to count that, right? And so it's those six plus steals. And anyway, I'm finding in 2 weeks that my team's pitching has won every category, and I'm falling short in all the offensive categories. And so a discussion came up where it's, should I decide to just tank? Should I bail on trying to be decent overall and just guaranteed win a couple of spots? Or should I not bail on trying to be good everywhere and just go on the long run and trying to have a good overall team, right?
Yeah.
And so we wanted to find this out mathematically. So I did some math, and here's how I began to approach it. I thought of it like, first I was trying to think of, like, if you want to win 4 out of 7 categories each week, you know, and then set a percentage. But that was too much. So I just did say you're playing somebody head to head in 3 categories. That's just the way I was able to wrap my head around this, right? So each week you want to obviously win either 2 or 3 of the games, right?
Yeah.
You're playing head to head in 3 categories. You're either going to get, you know, 3 wins, 2 wins and a loss, 1 win and 2 losses, or 3 losses. Now, I decided to say, is it better to have 80% odds in 2 of the 3, have 80-20, 80-20 that you'll win, and then 20-80 in the third, or 60-40, 60-40, 60-40? Both of those add up to 180 in total percentage, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you add up, you know, 60 times 3, obviously, it's the same as 80 plus 80 plus 20. It's 180, I'm sorry, is the total. So,
but what you're trying to get at basically is your overall expected wins.
Right, right. Which is better week to week, so to speak, or what is a better approach for categories, right?
Yep.
And what would you guess the results were? And how would you, I'll tell you how I did it, but what would you guess were the findings? I'll phrase it like this. Which one do you think of those two on the average week? This is the number I looked for. What percentage of weeks are you going to win 2 or more of your games?
What percentage of weeks are you going to win 2 of 3?
Right, the 60-60-60 team or 80-80-20, which is going to have a higher percentage of positive weeks?
I would say the 80-80-20.
Right. And the 80-80-20, so here's how I did it. I just calculate, all you do is times a percentage time, you know, of each possibility.
Sure.
So the 80-80-20 team, 70.704% of the time, you're happy with the week you had. You only win all 3 12% of the time, and the 60-40 team wins all 3 21% of the time.
Right.
But that 70% is compared to the 60-40 team, 64%, where you have a happy week. Also, with 80-20, you end up winless only 3.2% of the time, whereas the 60-40 team, it's 6.4% of the time.
Okay.
So it was pretty clear to me that it's better to have the 80-20 team, right?
Yes.
Even though you have a higher chance of winning all three of your games, right, 21-12, week to week, you have a 70 to 65% chance of having a positive week. And that's how you win. If you win 2 out of 3 every week, you're a good team, right?
Yes.
This is so much so, in fact, that even if you made it 63-37, the 80-20 team still has a positive week only by 0.04 more. But it's 0.700 for the 63% winning team compared to 0.704 for the 80-20 team.
Got it.
So what are your thoughts on this result?
Yeah, so that makes sense to me. It's all about the context, though, as well, where you got to look at the bigger picture, too, right? So, like, in our league, for example, we have 7 offensive categories. And this might seem kind of like an obvious minor thing to say, but you have to have this going through your head. So, in our league, there's 7 categories on offense. One of them is steals. In the other league I'm in, there's 5 categories, one of them is steals, right? So in that league, I think it's even more advantageous to have that sort of higher disparity, more 80-20 outcomes in the league where that particular category is more valuable,
if that makes sense. Yeah, but you know what else? And do you think this strategy is even viable in either of our leagues? Like, and where would you do it? Obviously, steals and saves are the clear one, but both of our leagues, both your two leagues and my and the league we're both in, has offensive strikeouts as a category. And that you can win by just benching everybody but your steals guy. Like, yeah. I literally could trade for Billy Hamilton, put him in and nobody else, and I'll win 2 out of the 7 offensive categories, and then I hope to sweep pitching, which is hard.
Well, here's another aspect to that as well. Let's say you start off the week, and this will only happen on certain weeks, but let's say you start your entire lineup. You want to win the strikeouts for the hitters, so the least strikeouts, and you want to have the most stolen bases, but OPS is also a category that's less of a counting category and more of an average category. So
you could put in one good hitter
off the week really hot, or you could do that too. You just put in your best hitter and your best steals guy. If your OPS is really
that's such
high,
a good point, because it's not a counting stat.
Take everybody out.
That's such a great point, because yeah, with a percentage stat, you could do this too.
Yeah, so you have, let's say, Joey Votto hits 2 home runs your first game. Take everybody out. You're definitely going to win steals, probably 98% of the time. You're going to win
if
steals.
If you have even him or VR, or even it might take 2 players, but you can easily manipulate that, right? There's a path to doing that. So that's a really great strategy. That's interesting.
But with that strategy, you're definitely going to lose total bases.
You're definitely losing the other 4. You're going to lose runs, total bases, home runs, and RBIs.
Yep.
How about pitching? With saves, I don't think there's as clear a way to win it.
Well, so when I played fantasy baseball 2 years ago, this was the strategy I was entailing at the time. And then when I started learning more about fantasy baseball, everyone was like, oh, this is the wrong way to do it. But I remember that I took 1 great starting pitcher and then I just loaded up with the top end closers. So, like, I'm not talking
what
about...
What kind of league was it?
It was head-to-head categories. And so it was like total saves, whip, ERA, wins, and then...
Well, with a great closer, much like your point with the OPS, you can win saves and whip and ERA.
Yeah, so what I would do would be when I would get ahead in saves and my ERA and whip were low, the second I would qualify for the innings count, I would basically take all the players out.
And how did that work out that year?
I ended up winning in one league and then coming
Don't
in
lie.
Second in the other league.
Tell the truth.
No, I did really well, but it was...
Was everyone active in the league?
most of the people were active, but it was not as competitive as the leagues we're in now.
Nah, I think you're exaggerating. Fight back with me.
I can show you my trophies on Yahoo. If you want to see these medals, they don't, you know.
Yo, there's a page of achievements. If you knew my password, you could see that crap too.
I got it right here.
Well, okay, but even in the bigger picture, even if it's not as manipulative, not manipulable, like just like when I'm drafting from now on, I am even more so than this year going after doing this exercise, I'm absolutely going to be thinking about what category am I drafting with this guy, not just all around good guy. Because like I said, I mean, even if it was 50-50, like I wonder with this experiment, if I did 2-2, like, you know, is that worth it? Like, is it worth it to give yourself a chance to be good? Like, because then it gets into, would you rather, are you guaranteed going to be 500? But I'd rather have a chance to win. The goal is to win, right? So it's like the more volatile way might make sense in that regard.
Yeah.
It always equals one. Probability always equals one. And that's what sucks.
Yeah, you're right. I think it also depends on the structure, how many teams make the playoffs. But let's say you're just trying to, if it's a full, say, head-to-head league where you don't have playoffs and it's like you just want to win first place, I think that's a good strategy to go with. Sort of focus on steals, do what I was saying with the OPS part, and then theoretically, right, like all of those picks you would have spent on, like the slightly above average positional hitters, you can pick up pretty good relievers or pitchers to sort of cement in, you know, locking down as many of those pitching categories as many weeks as possible. So yeah, I think it's a viable strategy.
I'm afraid I'm gonna do it and then only end up like two games over 500, but whatever. All right, so last thing, we're up against time. I mentioned that Byron Buxton is like Andrew Luck for me, in that Andrew Luck, I've never watched him with my own eyes be great. And for a while, I just, on faith, because everybody said he was great, I just was like, you know what? He must be great.
Oh, he's the second coming of John Elway.
Even though I've never seen it. And then finally, after his second year, I was like, wait, I haven't really seen him be great. Like, I've actually seen all these other quarterbacks be great with my own eyes. I haven't watched it with him yet. And anyway, so now I'm just all in going by what I see versus things. But I bailed on that freaking strategy, and I drafted Byron Buxton, and he sucks, yo. Is he broken? Is Byron Buxton broken?
I think so. Oh my God. I don't think he's broken. I think that he just, it was never there. He never hit well. Even in the minor leagues, they were saying, oh, he has this, oh, he's going to be such a great power hitter. Did he ever really hit for power? Not really.
No, but his hit tool was supposed to be good.
The other factor to that, too, is, right, fantasy versus reality. His baseline is always to be, like, a pretty great defensive outfielder, and then whatever he gives you at the plate is a bonus. But in reality, for fantasy, like, you don't care about defense,
right? But I know, but that's why he's in baseball. But still, he was here. This is on the 80-20 scale. This book is the 2016 Baseball America Prospect Handbook. He has this, these are his rankings on an 80-20 scale: arm 70, defense 70, speed 80, power 60, batting 70. I mean, he was all around supposed to be stud.
And are the, does it give that by itself, or does it say like 70 slash, because there's, what they'll do is they'll give current power and they'll give a number and then they give, you know, projected.
No, that's all it says, I think, because they knew he was about to come up or whatever. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But let me see his stats, actually. I know this isn't. With the retirement of Torrey Hunter and the trade of Aaron Hicks, the Twins project to have two starting spots open in the 2016 outfield. Provided Buxton makes a solid showing in the spring, he should be the opening day center fielder. If the Twins opt to play it safe and use Danny Santana in center, Buxton could open 2016 back at AAA. A fast start there should expedite his return engagement at Target Field. When he does return, the Twins hope it's for good. This is the same thing they're in now. It's like he's come back and he's not very good.
Well, that it, the thing with him too is like he was the top prospect in.
Yeah, he broke. It says since his 2013 breakout season, and then yeah. You want to hear his stats in 2013 that they're referencing?
Sure, but what level was it at?
Low A and high A.
Okay.
In low A, in 68 games, in 270 at-bats, he hit .341 with 32 steals, and he slugged .559, 8 homers, 15 triples, 10 triples, 15 doubles, 44 walks. He'll never walk in the majors in his life. He's going to strike out forever.
His strikeout rate is alarming.
Dude, he's hurt my team. My team on offense last week had more at-bats than my opponent, lost in every good category, and had more strikeouts single-handedly because of him and a little bit Greg Bird.
Greg Bird.
Friggin' Greg Bird. Fort Myers. Then he, in 2014, hit .240 and struck out a little more. And then in Chattanooga, hit .283 in Double-A. In Triple-A, he really only hit .413 games in Triple-A. Oh, my God. And then he sucks. Dude, he sucks. What are they talking about? I'm done.
Well, it's interesting, too, in, like, the context, all of the other guys, because that was a pretty good group. This is one of the best groups of young players baseball seen in a long time.
Tim Kirchen says he thinks this will be the best shortstop era ever.
Yeah, I think maybe even the best players ever, and for a whole number of reasons.
You are going to say that about the Bambino and Mick?
Like, you think about some of these players. So we have Corey Seager, Chris Bryant, Carlos Correa. Lindor was a little bit even lower rated. Man, that is like...
Yeah, that's what they were saying. I mean, just
the shortstop. He was above all of them. Like, he was rated ahead of all of those guys.
See, I don't know if overall it's hard to say because I don't know baseball history, but I know that there's never been... Kirchen was saying that like, Nomar, Jeter, and A-Rod were all... Oh, but they only overlapped for a little while. Right. Like, the seasons on offense and defense that Correa, Lindor, and Seager are capable of having is ridiculous. Like we said, out of nowhere... Troy Tulowitzki is the 12th best shortstop in baseball. That's insane.
That's mind-boggling. And then, you know, you go even lower on the totem pole, and they're pretty good. Like, Didi Gregorius is probably, what, like the 15th?
Yeah,
16th
and he's all – I would take him in a really second. Good. As yeah. Drubal even is like – he's only 31. I thought Drubal was older, man.
Got a big old chain.
Dude, how do you run the base? I don't got to worry about running the bases with the chain because I could jog them just as good.
He just hits home runs.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I could jog them just fine, dog. The last thing, when you're drafting a team in the show or anywhere, would you rather have a, and I think I know the answer for you, but would you rather have like a 96 overall first baseman or like a 89 or 90 overall center fielder or shortstop? Like, you could have either, let me think of like some players. Maybe who is the center fielder in Steve Finley, or you can have Miguel Cabrera. Who are you starting a franchise with? They're both going to be 19. It's
big
so
market
tough.
Team or a small market team?
Why, small market, you'd take the center fielder, or you'd take the – what would be different?
Yeah, I'm not sure that even it would make that big of a difference. My thinking was, let's say I'm the Yankees in the mid-90s, I'd always take the center fielder and shortstop because then you could pay to bring in the first baseman, which is exactly what they did.
And why that, though? Because you think it's easier to find a first baseman than a center fielder?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that first baseman, I think it's easier to get a bat that doesn't suck at first base
exactly.
than a great bat and good fielder in center field. However, what makes this tough is that I obviously have given you an amazing first baseman and like a great center fielder. Like, if I'm building a franchise, it's a tough call. I think I would end up, like, honestly, all else equal. Like, say, adjusting for position valuability.
Yeah.
Value. I just made up valuability. Say, adjusting for, like, position value, there was a draft board, right? And it had like, closer. Obviously, they'd be 100 out of 100 because nobody's going to take a closer first. And then maybe first baseman would be, like, 97, you know, stuff like that. I think I'd end up falling somewhere in the middle where, like, I would take, like, a third baseman who's, like, because at least there's some defensive value. They're not, they don't totally grow on trees, but I'd want still a really exciting power hitter, but not a first base. I'm making, like, the icky face at, like, first base. Like, I'm so upset Matt Carpenter plays first base now.
You know, I'm just, this is just, like, total stream of consciousness, but traditionally second base was always viewed as, like, you know, build up the middle, right?
Yeah, so yeah, that's, I hear old guys call the radio and say that.
More important than third base, but today I think third base is much more important. One, because, like, you know, the balls hit to third base, there's a lot of defense involved in that. There's quick reactions, the arm strength. But with the amount of shifting, I think second base,
it could go back,
has been negated to a large part.
Well, I think, well, it could go, I was going to say the opposite. With second base, it could, it maybe going back the other way, where the second baseman end up being the shortstop against lefties. But they already were. I mean, also, in this, in the handbook, like I read a couple episodes ago, they have position by position what tool you're looking for in each spot. And I was surprised to find that at second base, your hit tool is the most important, as opposed to what I thought would be fielding, you know?
Yeah, well, we've talked about that. That shift has definitely happened, because if you look at how deep second base is, apologize for the people who listen to this, like, often, but remember, it was Robinson Cano, Dustin Pedroia. Today, we have Daniel Murphy, Jonathan VR, although he plays some short.
Yeah, and Daniel Murphy is a perfect example. Like, he's not a good fielder, but he could hit awesome.
Altuve, Neil Walker, not a great fielder.
Right.
Pretty good hitter.
Exactly, exactly.
Wow, who, like, Starlin Castro, pretty good hitter, not a good fielder.
Right.
I
know, I can't think. There were more. Brian Dozier is a good, decent fielder, yeah, but he's a hitter. He's there for his hitting.
Kipnis. And then who's the guy in Colorado? DJ LeMahieu.
Oh, God. Who's a bitch who sat out to win the batting title last year. Ted Williams went and fought war and came back for the ninth inning.
You know, another thing I was going to bring up was in that whole Barry Bonds video you showed.
You were
me,
gonna, or you're not?
I am gonna now.
You
but
are.
You ain't gonna tell me what.
All right, go on.
Ted Williams, what if he didn't go to war? His numbers would be absurd.
Yeah. I think he was pretty good. No, I know. No, he's the best hitter ever. Well, maybe with steroids aside, I don't know. Steroids included, he's the best hitter ever. Steroids aside, obviously Barry Bonds is. But yeah, Ted Williams went to war, bro. That's crazy. Think about being Babe Ruth. You're the Babe, and you got to go in the coal mines in the off season. Like, I don't know if that's true, but
like, imagine if we sent Bryce Harper off to Iraq now. It would never happen.
He would cry. He would cry. He's back, by the way. We're so long on this episode, but I know I'm watching Full Metal Jacket, like in the opening scene, and they're cutting their hair. Bryce is back, yo. He's mad good.
I knew it.
And Eric Thames. I don't know. I still don't know how to say his name.
Thames.
We're big fans. He's great. He had another home run. All right, thank you guys. Goodbye.